This is Karin Zissis for ASCOA Online. No other issue has dominated the Trump era as has immigration. But for all the news headlines, net undocumented immigration from Mexico basically ended a decade ago, and demographic shifts, both in that country and Central America, could well mean the issue loses relevancy over time. Demography will also likely make white nativism a losing political strategy in the United States, explained Douglas Massey, co-founder of the Mexican Migration Project, in this podcast with ASCOA Online's Holly K. Sunderland.
You're listening to Latin America in Focus.
Latinoamérica en Foco.
América Latina en Foco.
Podcast by America Society, Council of the Americas, on politics, economics, and culture in the region.
Thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast.
I'm happy to be here.
Professor Massey, in the last month, you published a piece in The Conversation with some data on the quote-unquote crisis at the U.S. southern border. You also were on Malcolm Gladwell's Revisionist History podcast to talk about migration trends. And there were two findings from your research in these pieces that really stood out to me. One, you found that border apprehensions of migrants are down from 1.6 million in 2000 to just over 300,000 in 2017, which is their lowest level since 1970. And if you look at the number of apprehensions per border patrol officer, it's at the lowest level since 1943. Additionally, in 1980, a Mexican migrant was 50% likely to return home after his or her first trip, reflective of this pattern of circular migration that you documented for so many years. But by 2010, that was down to 0%. So what is happening at the U.S.'s southern border? And in particular, what differences are you seeing between migrants from Mexico and those from Central America?
Well, what's happened is that border traffic used to be dominated by Mexicans. In 2000, when there were 1.6 million apprehensions, 98.9% were Mexicans. Central Americans were always there, but they just got lost in the shuffle when there were so many Mexican apprehensions. And the Mexican movement was largely labor migration, with male workers coming to the United States for jobs, and to a lesser extent, family reunification with some dependents of male workers who began migrating, coming northward to join their fathers and husbands. When they started staying longer because of border enforcement, the border became very difficult and costly to cross, and so they stayed longer and longer and ended up settling in the U.S. Mexican migration, illegal migration from Mexico is basically over, and it's been negative for 10 years, which means that there are very few people coming to the United States, and there are more people leaving the United States and going back to Mexico than are entering. And so what's happened now is we have a different composition at the border. The border is increasingly Central American, as you can see from the news coverage and you can see from the actual statistics. Mexicans are currently about 42% of the apprehensions along the border. That's from 2017 statistics, which are the latest published ones. And Central American migration is quite different than Mexican migration. First of all, it's really not a labor migration. It's a migration of families, women, and children who are migrating not to access jobs or get benefits in the United States, but they're escaping threats at home, escaping often horrendous conditions that really date back to the U.S. intervention of the 1980s. If you look at the data, there was very little migration out of Central America to the United States prior to 1980. And when the Reagan administration came into power in early 1981, and the Sandinistas had just had their revolution in Nicaragua, he prosecuted an effort to overthrow the Sandinista government and to solidify anti-communism in Central America, launched the Contra War to depose the Nicaraguans with secret money that got him into a scandal at the end, and also funded right-wing governments and trained military governments in those countries and promoted a lot of the death squads that went around killing people. And there was a massive explosion of civil violence, which pushed people outward seeking refuge, and most came to the United States. Nicaraguans were welcomed as refugees from a left-wing communist government. And those migrants from Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras really couldn't be admitted as refugees because they were allied with, they were fleeing governments that were allied with the United States in the Cold War. And so they entered without documents, entered without authorization. And what we see now are really people migrating to Central, from Central America to the United States, who have family members in the U.S., but they're largely undocumented or in temporary protected status, which is going to end soon, and there's no way to legally reunite them. And they are escaping conditions that really stem from our intervention itself. After 1980, GDP per capita actually fell in absolute terms throughout the region, through Honduras, Guatemala, Salvador, and Nicaragua. And it didn't recover back to its 1980 level until around 1995. And then the economy has grown much more slowly than other Central American economies like Costa Rica and Panama. And so the violence really never went away. Mara Salvatrucha, the MS-13 gang that gets so much press, is actually an American gang founded in the Pico Union neighborhood of Los Angeles among Salvadorans who had nowhere to go because they were undocumented. The ones that were in their late teens were too old to go into American schools, and they ended up hanging out in the corners and forming gangs. And when they were deported back to Salvador, that was when Mara Salvatrucha took hold in El Salvador. So in essence, these people are, it's really not an immigration crisis in terms of numbers, in terms of the quantity of people coming. It's really more of a humanitarian crisis at the border, where people are escaping horrendous conditions in their countries of origin that really date back and can be traced directly to the U.S. intervention. And we're not assuming any responsibility for these people's welfare, although our intervention was a principal cause of the fact that they're coming to the United States right now.
Shifting to Mexico, Mexico just elected Andrés Manuel López Obrador, or AMLO, as president on July 1st, and he has said that he wants Mexico to be a place where people want to stay. How do you think U.S.-Mexico relations and cooperation on immigration, trade, and security might change under his presidency?
Well, he's made a lot of promises to a lot of people, so it's very difficult to say what López Obrador is actually going to do once he comes into office, which is on December 1st of this year. Mexico has become a country of immigration as well as emigration, and in some ways, it's more of a country of immigration at this point, since undocumented migration to the United States is basically over and has been for 10 years, and because of the changed demography of America, likely won't be coming back. Mexico is actually becoming an aging society and is experiencing its own labor shortages in the agricultural sector and increasingly employing people from Central America. Mexico, during the last presidency of Felipe Calderón, actually put in place a body of law to protect the rights of immigrants in Mexico that is actually, as a law, gives them more rights and standing than our own protections do in the United States right now. Now, that hasn't been fully enforced, of course, and there's a big gap between what the law says and what happens on the ground. But AMLO does have a legal body of jurisprudence to work with to guarantee the rights. And whether he means that he wants to attract migrants to live in Mexico or whether he wants to simply protect migrants who are traveling through Mexico to the United States really remains to be seen. So, it may be that AMLO will play a very interesting and clever game whereby he protects the rights of immigrants in Mexico and gets a lot of kudos on the world stage for that, but also allows them to travel into the United States. towards the northern border. A lot of one of the reasons that the flows have been lower in some years than others is because Mexico was taking a preemptive effort to stop people at its southern border with Guatemala. And if AMLO decides to let them freely come across and travel within Mexico and come to the northern border, we might see more of what we are observing now in future years. The seasonality of border crossings has really changed since Mexicans disappeared and Central Americans have become the bulk of the people along the border seeking to cross. The peak used to be in March, February, March, and April, when Mexicans who'd come home for the holidays were returning back to seasonal jobs in the United States. Now, since it's families and not workers, they're coming, the new peak is in June and July, right after school gets out and families with children are taking off. So next year in June and July, we'll see what happens and we'll see what López Obrador, the new president of Mexico, is really going to be doing. He owes nothing to the Trump administration, and Trump has made nothing but threats, and he may call Trump's bluff, just as China is doing on trade.
Yeah, so shifting then gears to the public debate in the U.S. on immigration, I want to read a quote you and your colleague Jorge Duran wrote. It starts, "A salient characteristic of the current debate on U.S. immigration policy is the high ratio of hot air to data. With respect to Mexico-U.S. migration in particular, political entrepreneurs, ideologues of all stripes, special interests, and many a rank opportunist employ the border as a stage on which to project their hopes, fears, and fantasies about the nation." End quote. Now, you wrote this in 2006. So would you like to update or amend your statement for 2018?
No, I would not. I think that is more accurate now than it was when I wrote it in 2006 about falsehoods. President Trump has done nothing but display falsehoods throughout his campaign, throughout his speeches, throughout his presidency. He would have Americans believe that millions of undocumented migrants continue to pour over the border into the United States, that they have high crime rates, that they have high disease rates, that they're not healthy, when in fact all the data show, and the data come from Homeland Security, from Pew Charitable Trust, I mean from Pew Research Center, from a lot of different sources, all show the same thing. Illegal migration from Mexico is actually over. It ended 10 years ago. It's been negative for a decade. Immigrant neighborhoods have lower crime rates than native neighborhoods. Immigrants as a whole have lower crime rates than natives do. Even undocumented migrants, aside from their immigration violations, have much lower crime rates than natives do. And immigrants are actually healthier on average than the average American. And as they stay longer in the United States, they tend to get more like Americans, which means they get more unhealthy over time. So all the basic premises upon which Trump is operating and framing his immigration policy and calling for the construction of a $25 billion border wall, all of them are false premises.
If you had the power to magically eliminate one term or phrase from the migration debate that you find particularly erroneous, what would it be?
One single term. That's a good one. Well, the debate is rather one-sided now with Trump commanding the stage. And he keeps talking about the danger and the threat of immigration, when in fact immigrants are not a threat. Going back to the late 60s and early 70s, the anthropologist Leo Chavez at University of California, Irvine, came up with the idea of the Latino threat narrative, which has gotten stronger in American discourse over time, which perceives migrants coming across the border as illegal migrants. And if they're illegal, by definition, they're lawbreakers and they are criminals and therefore a grave threat to the nation. I would just like to see the threat narrative disappear and to hear public figures and people in the news media stop referring to migrants as illegal migrants. You can talk about the flows as being illegal, but not the people. We need to bear in mind that it is not a criminal violation to be in the United States without authorization. It's a violation of civil law. It goes to civil courts, not criminal courts. And people are being treated along the border now, especially under the Trump administration, as criminals, being arrested for and charged with things that really don't apply to them as criminals. So if they got in by borrowing their brother's green card or something, that becomes document fraud and identity theft, when that's not really what it is. It's not really crime in the sense that we're usually thinking about it, where someone will steal an identity to use credit cards and make a lot of money. It's really an immigration violation. And the imprisonment of women and children and the separation of families for what in essence is a civil violation seems to be, to me, a very drastic punishment for a very minor infraction. And the mass deportations that are going on now, with hundreds of thousands of people being rounded up and deported from the United States for the crime of being here without authorization, which really isn't a crime, but simply a civil violation. There's a huge disproportionality between the punishment, which is deportation back to a place that people often haven't lived in for a decade or more, leaving their American-born citizen kids without a father, without a parent, and devastating consequences for families and communities. This is a huge punishment for what, in the end, is simply a civil infraction that could be rectified through civil means rather than criminal means.
One sort of follow-up question, too. This is more in the realm of legal migration, but also in terms of how immigrants are in their U.S. communities. And when you were talking about their integration and lower crime rates and adjustments, I noticed in the new ceremonies for U.S. citizenship naturalization, the welcome message from President Trump now includes a call for them to assimilate in American society, and that wasn't present in the previous presidential welcome messages. I wonder what you thought about the use of that word in that message.
That's part of the framing of immigrants as a threatening other in American dialogue, assuming that somehow they don't want to assimilate, that they are resistant to learning English. A lot of Americans believe that today's immigration is quite different from immigration in the past. But when you look at what was going on in the past and compare it with what's going on today, it's actually very similar. Immigrants arrive, of course, speaking another language. It takes time for the first generation to learn to speak English. They never learn to speak really without an accent if they came here as adults. And some of them don't speak very well. And some of the older ones, if people come over in their old ages to be with their children in the United States, they may not ever learn English. The same thing happened in the early 20th century with the Italian and Polish migrations. But if you look at the second generation, people who were either born in the United States or came here as children and grew up in the United States, they quickly switch over into English as their dominant language. They may continue to speak basic Spanish, like household Spanish, with fellow Mexicans and Latinos and in the homes, but they were educated mainly in the United States, and they don't know how to read and write very well in Spanish, and they don't know the sophisticated Spanish to talk about abstract concepts and complicated subject matter. They're better at that in English. So by pushing people to assimilate, you're less likely to get them to learn English and become more Americanized than you are to get a reactive ethnicity. As you push and say, you've got to do this, you've got to do that, people will react and say, no, I'm proud of being Mexican. If you just let them do what they're going to do to get by in American society, integration and assimilation will just come about as a byproduct. The more you stand on a soapbox and tell people what to do, the more resistant they'll get, especially if that that demand to become like us is paired with a lot of discrimination, racialized imagery, and vituperation against an entire sets of people.
And I mean, if the tables were turned and all of a sudden, U.S. tourists to Cancun are being required to speak Spanish, I can't imagine that would go over very well.
No, and most Americans don't realize that assimilation is really a two-way street. When immigrant populations come into the United States, they change over time, but also America changes over time. and what would seem foreign two generations ago is now mainstream American. So the Italian influence, the Jewish influence, the Polish influence in American life today is accepted as quintessentially American. And, you know, 20 years from now, I think the Latino influence in American life will be quintessentially American. The United States has always been a changing culture, a changing society, and an agents of change have been technology, but also immigration. And it's made us a much richer country and culture than we would otherwise be. And I think that eventually we'll get back to that point of view. This is not the first anti-immigrant reaction in American history. The formula for a nativist reaction consists of two things. First, a sharp rise in economic insecurity and inequality, combined with rapid demographic change through immigration. When you get those two things together, you get a nativist reaction. You got it in the 1850s with the Know Nothing movement. You got it in the 1880s with the Chinese Immigration Exclusion Acts. You got it in the 1920s with the reaction against Southern and Eastern Europeans. And now you're getting it again in reaction to Latinos principally, but also in other and more subtle ways, Asians, and a dramatic fear of Muslim immigrants, even though they're a tiny, tiny fraction of immigrants to the United States to begin with. So, and this is being driven at this point from the top of the American political structure with Congress and the White House leading the way to demonize immigrants as un-American, when in fact, immigrants are quintessentially Americans. We've always been a country of immigrants. Trump's forebears were immigrants. My forebears were immigrants. And to deny this is to deny the reality of what is the United States of America.
Mm-hmm. And speaking about Congress and top of the administration, one issue, I wanted to get your thoughts on one issue that's been in the news, which is the how to approach ICE. So U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, created in 2003 via the Patriot Act, and which replaced the Immigration and Naturalization Service. So the debate, particularly on the left, has been whether to abolish ICE, as it were, or to reform and revamp it. So if you were advising U.S. Congress or a presidential administration, what would you recommend be done with ICE and why?
Well, ICE really has a mission to capture and detain people. And this mission is less connected now with actual immigration enforcement than with the economic mandate to fill bed space within privately owned prisons. Most Americans don't realize, but GeoCorp and Corrections Corporation of America, the two largest private prison firms, successfully lobbied Congress to put a quota on beds filled by immigration detentions. And the immigration detention system is now the most rapidly growing part of the prison industrial complex. And ICE agents are not really enforcing immigration laws so much as going out and finding people to fill the beds that they are going to pay for, whether they fill them or not. So I think the whole enterprise of immigration enforcement is fairly corrupt. It's dominated now by the Border Patrol unions and the ICE unions, who actually sued Obama, claiming he wasn't enforcing immigration laws successfully or faithfully, and have a vested interest in the whole criminal justice complex that has really taken over the immigration enforcement system. We've done deportations before, and you can do it with whatever agency. So the particular agency is less important than the way the system works and the way it's set up. Personally, I think ICE has acquired such a negative reputation that it would need to be dismantled, and whatever immigration reform enforcement put together to replace it would be done under a different agency with a different name and a different mission. I noticed a huge difference when immigration enforcement shifted from being in the Department of Justice, whose mission is actually justice, to the Department of Homeland Security, where basically in the Justice Department, you're presumed to be innocent until proven guilty. In Homeland Security, you're assumed to be a threat until proved otherwise. And it's a really different mentality for enforcement. You can see the same attitude in immigration data. When immigration statistics was part of the Justice Department, you got a lot more information published. But as it switched over to Homeland Security, that branch of government has become more and more restrictive in the amount of information it releases, and is canceling data projects and cutting back on the data released to the public. So it's become more and more secretive over time.
Mm-hmm. And just one more question to wrap things up. So, I mean, we're in a pretty extraordinary moment in terms of migration and our borders. Looking ahead to the long term, what factors do you think will shape Mexican and Central American migration in the years to come?
Well, I think Mexican migration will continue to the extent that the North American economy remains integrated under NAFTA, with lots of movements of goods, capital, information, services going across the borders between Canada, the U.S., and Mexico. And with this sort of economic integration, there's obviously going to be movement of people. And right now, what you're seeing is, over the past decade, a large increase in people migrating in legal status from Mexico, many with temporary visas of various sorts that really grew out of the integration of the North American economy under NAFTA. And NAFTA itself created its own visa categories, TN visas, which are temporary NAFTA visas for workers, professional workers in the United States, which brings in, 50,000 or so more people per year. And if you look at the data, temporary labor entries from Mexico are running at between 350 and 400,000 people per year, and permanent resident entries running between 150 and 200,000 per year. Most of them, three quarters of those people, are relatives of U.S. citizens who are exempt from numerical limitations. So I think we'll see a continuation of migration from Mexico to the United States, mostly in legal status in the future. I think illegal migration is pretty much over because of Mexico's fertility transition, where the fertility rate dropped from about 6.8 children per woman in the 1960s to 2.2 children today, which is replacement level fertility. Mexico's become an aging society. Basically, it's aged out of the migration years. And Central America migration will continue as long as the conditions in that part of the world are so bad that people see no other option but to try their luck in coming to America. But even there, the demographic potential for large numbers of migrants is really quite small compared to Mexico. Mexico, it took about 50 years from the 1940s to the late 1990s for about 10% of Mexico to end up in the United States. And Mexico is a huge country of 120 to 130 million people. Salvador is like 5 million people. Guatemala is like 8 million people. Guatemala is in the teens. So the numbers aren't very big down there. And El Salvador is already below replacement level. Honduras is falling to replacement level fertility. Guatemala is still growing, but its fertility rate is also rapidly falling. So the potential for massive migration out of Latin America is really small compared to what the Europeans are dealing with in Africa and the Middle East. Latin America is a region. Its fertility is at replacement level. It's not growing rapidly. It's got a stable middle class and growing middle class in most places. With the exception of Venezuela, there are no failed states in Latin America. So we just don't have the demographic potential in the Western Hemisphere for the mass migration that we saw out of Mexico in the 1980s and early 1990s. And so I think that now is the time to really reform our immigration laws and bring them into connection with reality. The ones we have now are just completely disconnected from the underlying reality. It's not a rational policy to build a $25 billion wall on one border out of four borders, two seaboards and one with Canada, to combat terrorism, because the terrorists will find other ways in if you only block one border. And in fact, Mexican illegal migration is over, and by all indications won't be coming back because the demography has shifted so dramatically in Mexico. So we need a more realistic immigration policy that recognizes what position the United States plays in the Western Hemisphere, and one that is much more cooperative and integrated within the Western Hemisphere to create a more peaceful and prosperous and growing Western Hemispheric economy.
Yes, and we shall see after midterms if the incoming Congress might actually be able to take that chance and tackle this policy.
We'll see. The one saving grace I always look to is that the demography of the United States is against what's happening now. And they can put off the political change that's going to happen when demography changes, but they can't stop it. So if you look at births today, a quarter of all births are to Latina women. About 11 or 12% are Black, and about 7 or 8% are Asian, and then a big chunk are all mixed up. And less than half of all births are to white European origin women. And so we're going to shift in America towards a new demography, and beating on people who have Latino origins or Black origins or Asian origins is will increasingly become a political loser.
And I mean, this is a very specific example, but do you see Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez beating Joe Crowley as sort of an indication of that shift?
It's an indication of the generational shift. And of course, it's not new in American society. There was an old Anglo-WASP ascendancy that resisted the rise of the ethnic political machines of Irish and Italians and Poles and in places like Chicago and New York. And eventually they had to succumb to reality. And if you look at the data, these anti-immigrant movements tend to peter out whenever immigrants become reach about 20% of any congressional district or voting district. And then it becomes really a losing proposition to demonize those immigrants and their children, who thanks to the 14th Amendment, are all U.S. citizens if they're born here. And so 25% of births are now Latino. So 18 years from now, 25% of the new voting population will be Latino. And at that point, beating on Latinos and demonizing Latinos is not going to be a very smart strategy. And the Republican Party, I think, is signing its own death warrant as we speak. And they're going to have to reinvent themselves in some radical way, because white nativism is not going to work in the country very much longer. And it really shouldn't have worked in 2016, which was anomalous in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. And sorry, I know I promised that I had already asked my last question, but I had one more question. Talking about Latino representation in districts, I know for a long time the trend has been that Latinos are over-concentrated in certain U.S. congressional districts, so that the effect is that then they're underrepresented on the national basis. I mean, I think the one stat that people like to cite is that 2/3 of Latinos in the U.S. live in California, Texas, and New York.
Don't forget Illinois.
And Illinois. Okay. So I'm just wondering, what trends are you seeing in terms of, are Latinos still staying in these concentrated areas, or are you seeing more of us spreading out throughout the country?
The big story of the 1990s was the diversification of geographic destinations for especially Central American and Mexican immigrants. And this is partly a result of our own border policy. We hardened the border drastically in El Paso and San Diego, and particularly in San Diego, which was responsible for about 2/3 of undocumented border crossers prior to the 1990s. And since the 1990s, it's dropped permanently to around 1/3 of border crossers. And so we diverted the flows away from California through the Sonoran Desert into Arizona. And during the 1990s, when jobs were opening up all over the country because of the economic boom, and there was a massive redistribution of immigration and the rise of new immigrant destination areas. And the most rapidly growing Latino populations are not in California now. They're in North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Iowa, Nebraska, and so on. And because undocumented migration has basically ended for the past 10 years, the growth is not coming from immigration so much now as from births in the United States. And we've seen a real diversification of the immigrant population throughout the country. So it's true that they are still concentrated in traditional destination areas. The big six are California, Texas, Illinois, New Jersey, New York, and Florida. But they're deconcentrating out of those areas and becoming more and more present throughout the country. As we've seen when raids are occurring now in some food processing towns in the Midwest and the South, local citizens are getting up in arms and outraged about the disruption to their lives and to their communities. So it's a different kettle of fish at this point. Immigrants are becoming much more, and Latinos especially, are becoming much more distributed throughout the entire country.
Well, thank you so much. That is everything I have for today, but we really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us about these issues.
Okay. Well, I thank you for trying to get the word out. It's tough.
Take care.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. I'm your host, Karin Zissis. This podcast was produced by Elizabeth Gonzalez. The music in this podcast was recorded at America Society in New York City. Find out about upcoming concerts at musicoftheamericas.org. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. If so, write us a review and subscribe at iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, or Stitcher.